Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths,
the program devoted
to those of you who are open to the realization that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt and counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, toll-free, 877-376-45. Friday is a day that we invert our program. We typically begin with a commentary on the news and then move to a explanation as to how you can engage in a relationship with Yahweh, how you can come to know him, even prove his existence, and then discover what it is that he's looking for, as well as exposing and condemning those things that confuse people and lead them in the wrong direction. But today we're going to begin with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and then move to the news in the second hour. We were covering the beginning of a discussion in the most prolific of the prophetic discourses, the one that we have the entire text of, the entire scroll from beginning to end. It's called the Great Isaiah Scroll. The name of the prophet is actually Yasha Ya'u. It means salvation is from Yahweh. And it is a declaration against Christianity. And it begins by addressing the nature of religion and then concludes by zeroing in on the founder of the Christian religion, calling him deadly. That individual would be Shaul, who is known to Christians as the Apostle Paul. And it begins with a word, Kirk, that should cause anyone who is reading further to say, I better pay close attention to what follows.
Oh.
Oi, huh?
Oh, yeah,
oi. Oi, oi. You know, you've heard, how many times have you heard?
Oi vey.
Yeah, in Yiddish, oi vey. Oh, that's, alas. It conveys two things, and maybe three, to be fair. The first is just, whoa. Now, when you are alas, woe and alas cover the concept of, this is not good. Oi vey, oh no, you know, this is bad. And when Yahweh is speaking, it happens to be God's one and only name in first person, and he says, this is bad, you can probably take it to the bank that this isn't very good. And the second thing is that it's one thing to point out a warning and say, you know, this is bad. You know, it's like a parent does. This is good. This is bad. But oi also conveys the idea of, I'm bringing this to your attention. Pay attention. You know, this warning is important. It's not just that this is bad. For example, drinking unfiltered, unpurified water out of a stream or a lake is bad. The likelihood of you getting very sick is very high. It doesn't come with a godly warning. But when things are pervasive, when they affect billions of people, and when the effect is the destruction of their soul, the sacrifice of their soul, the death of their soul, now that earns a warning.
Well, that's the ultimate thing he's trying to save, is our soul, to keep us. We are our soul more than anything else. The body's going to deteriorate anyway.
And what's really interesting is the irony of the fact that the number one thing from which Yahweh is trying to save our soul is religion.
Yes.
Those in the business of claiming to save souls is the very institution, the very people from which and from whom Yahweh is trying to save us.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a classic case. He's trying to warn us about religion, telling us that religion is bad, that it's intoxicating. And that's the biggest problem of religion, is it is intoxicating. It makes people feel comfortable. It makes them feel better at funerals. It makes them feel better when they go to church. It makes them feel better when they, you know,
participate.
participate. You know, a jihadist can be murderous, he can be a rapist, he can be a pedophile, he can be a thief, he can be a liar, and he can feel good about those things by reciting the Quran and Hadith. Religion is very good at making people feel a certain way.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so that's how it prevails. It's intoxicating. It's just like propaganda and patriotism and politics. And, you know, when I hear Republicans speak about Republicans, they're spewing an intoxicating drivel that appeals to Christian conservatives. And when I hear the leftist news spewing that which stirs the passions of their party, of the Democratic Party in America, you know that every word of it is appealing, makes the socialist secular humanist
feel good. Yeah.
Feel good. Oh, and the abominator said, my heart is broken over the two individuals that were needlessly shot, the journalists in Virginia. It makes the, and then the, therefore we need to apply restrictions on guns. Mm-hmm. It makes the liberal feel good.
Yes, they've protected us collectively.
Yeah. So it's from the intoxication of Ephraim that this warning is being made, and there are three aspects of this that if you're just reading it superficially, you're not going to get any of it. And I think that's the way that God intended it to be. If you're going to read it superficially, there is none of this that's going to resonate with you. So that's the reason why Yahweh must use close to 700 times the word shamar, closely examine and carefully consider, because when you dig deep, when you scratch beneath the surface, when you examine what these words mean, what they are symbolic of, oh, man, then they scream out to you. They're brilliant.
Shamar was written 700 times?
Yeah, about 700 times.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
But, you know, shamar and shama are the operative verbs of the Torah.
Absolutely.
You know, Yahweh constantly, Yahweh never once asks us to talk to him. He never asks us for our Dabar words. He never asks us to Amar, Yabaron.
No.
Never once.
No.
What he tells us is, listen to me. Closely examine and carefully consider what I have presented to you in my Torah. And he does that because, you know, we're looking at the owner's manual.
Mm-hmm.
The instruction manual as to how to get the most out of our soul. And, you know, we could provide Yahweh with just really beautiful lip service. We could make the most beautiful carols and the most beautiful hymns and the most beautiful music and the most beautiful sermons and oratory and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't told him anything that's useful to him, nor said anything that was beneficial to us.
Do you go to your golf pro and take a lesson and tell him what he should teach you?
No. No. No, I don't. What God wants us to do is closely examine and carefully consider. And when we do, we learn a lot. So what is he conveying here? He's using this warning is about Ephraim. The presentation of Ephraim is detailed in the book of Hosea. So if you want to understand why he chose Ephraim, what Ephraim means, you've got to go to the book of Hosea. And when you go to the book of Hosea, Hosea means salvation. It's a really interesting book in that Yahweh did something with Hosea that he doesn't do a lot. But he did it the same thing with Hosea effectively he did with Moshe. With Moshe, he said, you know, I want you to go with me into Egypt, and I want you to lead my children out of Egypt. He put Moshe in his position.
Mm-hmm.
So that Moshe, when he provided us with the Dvarim words, which is a further focus on an explanation on the Torah from from the experience of someone who lived it. Moshe could speak authoritatively. He could speak with great understanding because he had walked with Yahweh and had engaged and experienced exactly what Yahweh engaged with when he had to deal with the religious and political and militaristic slavery culture of Egypt. And he had to live and spend time with Yahweh as he had to endure the less than ideal behavior of the children of Yisrael. And how difficult they were to teach, how hard-headed they were, how prone they were to revert back to religion. And so, when you look at Hosea, what's the first thing? You know what Yahweh did with Hosea before Hosea really became a prophet?
Isn't that the one that he married?
And then he told
three children, and he told him what the name of.
Yeah, he said, I want you to go off and marry a temple prostitute.
Yeah.
A whore. I want you to, but not just a whore. I want you to marry a religious whore, a temple prostitute. I want you to marry the whore of Babylon.
Right.
A religious whore. That's what I want you to go do. And, name her Gomer. And so what Yahweh wanted Hosea to be able to do, because Yahweh likes to communicate through people as opposed to just this, great big voice in the sky. And when he put Hosea in that position, where Hosea was married now to a temple prostitute, to a religious whore, then Hosea could convey Yahweh's insights regarding Ephraim in a way that would resonate because he himself experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
It's when I finally came to write the final version of Questioning Paul, I felt for the first time in my life that my experience as a Christian actually had a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly as I rewrote that first chapter and spoke about the great conflicts in Christianity as to where just a bit of rational juxtaposition proves that the religion is absolutely false, just to encourage people to open their minds. And if it hadn't been a Christian, I would not have known those things.
No, you couldn't deal with you had to be there to do it.
Right. So Hosea was asked to marry a temple prostitute so that he would understand what God is going through, because what Ephraim represents is adultery, spiritual adultery. He represents what it's the thing that God hates the most. When religions are presented as a way to define him, to serve him, and to be saved by him, he despises it. And so he considers that to be adultery, unfaithfulness.
Yeah.
And so that's the book of Hosea. And the whole book of Hosea is Hosea dealing with Ephraim as a religious entity. And Yahweh is saying, you're not my children anymore. I'm not going to have anything to do with you for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that you are religious whores.
Yeah, you chose your side.
Right. So when he's using Ephraim here, who's he talking about?
He's talking about the Christian world, but there he's talking about Israel is doing the same thing.
Yeah. Right. Religious Israel.
Religious Israel.
Right. And since Christianity claims to be based on the, Abrahamic, and it carries around the Torah, prophets, and Psalms as part of its Bible.
Prove it, yeah.
Yeah. It's an outgrowth of this.
Uh-huh.
The living embodiment of it today. And so he's using the term that is, there's really only two terms in the total of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that scream out, this is man's religious manifestation. This is man being religious and being estranged from me. This is the very thing that causes me to say, I want nothing to do with you. One of them is Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
The other is Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the two.
Right. Well, you can't get more influence.
Now, the difference is, and this is, I think, the reason he used Ephraim here. There is a difference between Ephraim and Babylon. You've already mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
Why would he use, in some cases, for example, with Abraham, he asked him to walk away from Babel.
Right.
And in the Revelation, he says, and he speaks of the whore of Babylon. And the beast and Daniel grow out of Babylon. And the finally, it's, you know, Babylon is dead.
Yeah.
Finally. So there are times when he speaks of Babylon, and there's times that he speaks of Ephraim.
Yeah.
They both represent religion, but not exactly from the same perspective. What's the difference between the two?
Well, one's walking out. Well, you walk out of Babylon, Ephraim walked right back into it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the first thing I
yes.
think of.
Yeah, yeah. The difference is that Babylon is always estranged. Yeah, Babylon is always estranged. Never part of the covenant, always estranged, always bad, always confusing, always religious, always militaristic, always political. Babylon is never part of anything. You have to walk away from it.
No, but Ephraim...
Different story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ephraim was part of the covenant, wasn't he?
Right. Yeah.
But Ephraim was part of Israel, wasn't it?
He was a very special one.
Right. So in the case of Ephraim, what it represents is those who knew the truth, those who have been exposed to the truth, those who had the opportunity to be part of the family, those that were should have been part of the family that chose to squander it by being religious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any Christianity in that?
Totally.
Yeah, because what did Christianity corrupt to create the Babylonian religion?
Well, they took Yahusha's words, which were
right.
the Torah,
mm-hmm.
and just twisted them and completely
right.
ignored them or completely
right.
twisted them.
And they took Paul's letters, which were based on a wholesale repudiation of the Torah,
and
made that the basis of their religion.
Yeah.
They were freed from the Torah. The Torah was once valid, and they were freed from it. Ephraim was once valid, but Ephraim was now freed and distinct, separated
mm-hmm.
from Yahweh and his Torah and his covenant. So Christianity, particularly Pauline Christianity, is a perfect fit for Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as King Saul is a perfect metaphor to explain the wannabe Apostle Paul,
mm-hmm.
same name, same exact story,
right.
same consequence, same warning. Same thing is true of Ephraim being an example, a symbol, a historic parable that is both true historically, but was a perfect way to describe Christianity.
Yeah, Ephraim, it really blows me away, though. I mean, I understand it, I get it, but it's still, he's so important, so close. They, as a group, were so, they were right there. They were that far, you know, they go to the same temple. I mean, they went.
Yeah, but you take this way. How could you be part of the Exodus? All of the, you know, your slaves, and you have no power, no influence whatsoever. Your sons are killed within their first month.
Yeah.
You are being tortured and abused by the most powerful, most religious, most militaristic nation on earth. And this 80-year-old man waltzes in, speaking on behalf of a God you don't even know that you've heard about, Yahweh, and he brings that civilization to its knees.
Yeah.
And he wipes them out militarily, wipes them out financially, and frees you from them. And you've watched all of these miracles, and then you have Aaron saying, well, let's build this altar because tomorrow is the festival feast, the Chag, the Moed Mikre of Yahweh. And they create their own version of Yahweh as a golden calf.
Uh-huh.
Just as, you know, Christians created their own version of God as Jesus Christ.
Right. I hear it. I just freaked out by it.
Yeah, one of my closest friends tells me, you know, I just don't get it. How could you turn that quickly? Well, how could you turn if you're Ephraim? But they did. You know, and I think a lot of it, Kirk, is the feeling that drives religion, how intoxicating it is.
Right.
That it becomes woven into the culture. You know, somebody that is eloquent says it. And then it makes them feel good. They look at they're making a God that they can actually see and touch. You know, and they're back in familial territory, you know, with the gods of Egypt. And they're applying to the Egyptian god some of the attributes of Yahweh, so it makes them feel good. You know, that's what it means to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see God's reaction to it. What do you say to Ephraim? They're going to the same synagogues.
Yeah.
You're not my children. Not my children. And, of course, over time, Ephraim becomes synonymous with Israel. And it becomes Yahudah, distinct from Yisrael. And the reason for that is the departure of Benjamin. Benjamin was part of Yahudah and separate from Ephraim initially. But Benjamin became the wolf in sheep's clothing and became the most vicious animal in terms of being the traitor against Yahudah. And so it became Yahudah versus Yisrael because of Benjamin joining the religious anti-Yahweh.
And Yahweh said that's what he would be, too.
Yep, and Yahweh told us that that it would be Benjamin that would be the one, the wolf that would be in opposition. So, and of course, Paul was the Benjamite. Oh. Told you twice.
Well, you remember Absalom? Yeah. He ran to the Benjamites in order to fight his king, his father, Dod.
Yes. Oh, that's, yeah, isn't that interesting? Same exact. Yeah, same exactly. And Dod was of what tribe?
Yeah.
Yahudah, right?
Yehuda.
Yeah, he's with the tribe of Yahudah.
He finds his allies in Benjamin, right, too, and raises his army to attack his father.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so here you have Ephraim, which is synonymous not only for religion, but for religion that whose foundation, whose origins are the truth and the covenant. So, you know, just like Christianity, they carry around the Torah, the prophets, the Psalms. They claim to be an Abrahamic religion. They claim that their church has taken over for Israel. Now, what does it say about this religious entity? It says three different things about them. They're presumptive. They are control-oriented. And number three, they're intoxicating.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that sure does describe religion in almost any culture today, including socialist secular humanism in America's media and academia. Five words. It's a fairly simple start. A warning about something that's really bad. A name that is synonymous with not just religion, but with religion with foundational claims to that which is true. And then the adjectives regarding that religion are that it is presumptive, making self-adulating, making claims of its own importance that are unwarranted, that it seeks power and control, and does so in a manner that embraces the circle, encompassing people, and circles are what the wreath of victory, if you will, the basis of Christian church.
Right.
And that this these things lead to the intoxication of religious individuals, where their judgment is impaired, their thinking is impaired, and they stumble away.
Mm-hmm.
They become forgetful and thus forgotten.
They get indoctrinated. I mean, you know, it's like the catechisms and all the things that the church has used to start them out young, and then they're pretty well finished at that point.
In the first two sentences, Kirk, we have a reference to intoxication twice, different words.
Right.
So it's really important to look at the shadings. And the shading of Shakur is that of your reasoning and judgment being affected. And that those whose reasoning and judgment are negatively affected have a tendency to be forgetful. And to be forgetful in this case is to be forgotten, because we're talking about Ephraim. Ephraim knew the truth. Ephraim was part of the family, so they had to forget the Torah to be forgotten by its author. Yeah.
How did, at the end of Solomon dies, and you got Rehoboam and Jeroboam, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did they wind up thinking they could have a king in the northern tribes? I mean, yeah. That's pretty arrogant.
Arrogant.
That wasn't the blessing given to them.
Mm-mm.
So there's nothing in the Torah that you could look back and say, we're allowed to have our own leader. I mean, obviously you can't have your own temple and your own priesthood. I mean,
when Theodosius, the military and political leader of Rome, decided to announce that he was the Pope of the new religion, and that that religion was going to be imposed on everyone, and that he was the head of that religious entity, and that the religion and politics and militarism of Rome were all unified into a singular thing. You don't think that that was a bit presumptive?
Well, at that stage, but I mean, we were talking about people who weren't that far removed from Dode.
I mean, no, but we're talking about people here that aren't very far removed from Yosha.
That's true. That's very true. Good point.
I think the parallels are extraordinary,
mm-hmm.
between Ephraim and the Christian church as it grew out of the beast of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you got the three things. You got them. And it's really interesting here that Shakor is used in reference to Ephraim, religion and religious institutions that are extensions of that which was once true. Which was always true, but they knew what was true. Their foundation is the same as the foundation of Christianity. The foundation is true. It's just that what they've done with it takes it right back to Babel. You know, that's why if Christianity didn't have an Old Testament, if it didn't lug around the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, then Ephraim wouldn't apply to them.
Yeah.
But they do.
But they do. They do.
And but yet they've forgotten the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and therefore they are forgotten. What did Yahweh say about the means in Hosea of causing your soul to cease to exist? How do you go about causing your soul not to exist?
Well, you can forget him, and he'll forget you.
Yeah, that's the consequence. What he said is that lack of knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Lack of understanding.
Yeah, my children are lost for lack.
Right. Yeah, my children are destroyed. Their souls cease to exist for lack of knowledge, lack of understanding.
Right.
So they forgot the Torah. And in fact, he then goes on to explain, he says, just in case you didn't understand what I'm talking about here, but I'm not just talking about stupid. I'm talking about you rejected my Torah. He goes on to clarify it. He says, you know, because you forgot my Torah, I'm going to forget your children.
Yeah.
So when you're dealing with Christianity, because you have forgotten my Torah, I'm going to forget your children.
And your children.
Okay. And, yeah. That's why he wrote in a second statement, the etched in stone, that fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation.
In this case, forever, seems like.
Yeah, almost forever. You know, the third and fourth generation doesn't mean that it stops there.
No, it just means they, yeah.
So we have a religious entity that that claims, that has foundational claims to the truth, just as does Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And the intoxicating nature of it, that it not only impairs a person's reasoning and judgment, which is what Christianity does. If you share any of this with a Christian, in fact, if you prove that there is no New Testament, no New Covenant, that if you prove emphatically, undeniably, that Paul was a false prophet, doesn't influence them at all, because they can't exercise good judgment when it comes to their faith.
Mm-hmm.
They won't even think about it. Won't even entertain it.
No, I've encountered that recently. At least on two occasions, they just totally shut down to the point there's no point talking.
If you talk to a drunk person, can you reason with them?
No. No.
You ever tried to reason with a drunk person?
Yes.
No.
You can't do it.
No, you can't do it. Why? Because their judgment's impaired.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the same thing trying to reason with a religious person. You can't do it. Their judgment is impaired. That's why he uses these terms.
Yeah. I never grasped that initially, you know, early on. I know it now. I've known it for some time, but it was amazing. I'm dumbfounded when that happens.
Yeah. You know, if you were once were in the right position where the truth was all around you,
mm-hmm.
and you based your understanding initially on the truth, and you just moved away from it.
Yeah.
You still wouldn't be doomed. There would still be hope.
Yeah, you could find your way back.
Yeah, up to the point you become intoxicated, your judgment is impaired by the prevalence of the religion in your community and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point,
overwhelmed. Yeah.
At that point, once your judgment is impaired and you can't reason anymore, that's why religious people, for them, there is no hope.
Well, that's
why God hates it so much.
Right, that's what patriotism has done to this country.
Correct.
That in academia. I mean, it's just we have put such a high emphasis on these PhDs, and I'm not against somebody knowing stuff by any means, but we put such a, like we did with doctors, we treated them like gods.
Yeah.
We treat our generals like they're there to save us.
Hey, a long story, a study was just completed and published, Kirk, that analyzes mass shootings and the perpetrators of mass shootings. And they wanted to make the claim that guns are the common denominator of mass shootings, but that's brain dead. You know, if it was mass murder, and then you look at guns as being a common denominator, you can say, okay, that's a reasonable issue. But if you say mass shootings, and you say the guns are a common denominator, that's stupid. Okay, but there were several other things that were common denominators. Do you know what the first one was? American exceptionalism.
Oh yeah, God.
This the very thing you're talking about now.
I hate this.
This misguided sense of self-importance and that, you know, everything in America ought to be easy. Everybody ought to have a nice house and a nice car and a nice family, and you don't have to work for them. It's just part of your birthright of being an American. And by being an American, you're just better. American exceptionalism. And they say that a disconnect between Americans' view of themselves and the country and what ought to be versus what actually is the single most disorienting factor that causes mass shooters. That if you look at their manifesto, like for example this guy that just killed the two journalists,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's all about this conflict between American exceptionalism and reality. The second, of course, is psychiatric issues and mind and body altering drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them are seeing psychiatrists or are taking mind altering drugs or, you know, the painkillers, mood elevators, you know, antidepressants. But that's the second most common denominator in the mix. So what you're saying is exactly right, but intoxication is the key element. Even Yahweh can't save those who are intoxicated by religion. God himself can't save them.
And that's true. That's him talking.
Right. He's talking here in first person. He says, whoa, this is a warning. This is really bad, those who are intoxicated by religion. Now, he did say two other things about religion. One is that it's presumptive. It makes claims that just are not true. Very arrogant claims that are not true. Almost every religion is making arrogant claims, and you're only saved if you buy into their religion. Unless you have the Eucharist, you're part of the Roman Catholic Church, you can't be saved. This notion that, you know, you either surrender to Allah or you can't be saved. Religions make preposterous claims. And religion has a tendency to create arrogant participants. You know, talking about the superior nature, the exceptionalism of their religion. But they're claiming the authority of God, and God didn't give them the authority.
No.
So presumptive and arrogant. And then it is a search for control, and he uses a word for crown that is equal parts crown and wreath, the wreath being a symbol of victory for pagans, and the crown being a symbol of human authority over those institutions. God doesn't grant us either.
No.
Doesn't want us involved in either. And you know when you become part of the covenant?
You're
you don't want either. Do you want authority? Do you want power?
No.
God, do you want to be responsible?
I really don't.
No, I don't either. In fact, I want exactly the opposite. What I love about the covenant, I'm not responsible. Except for shemaring Yahweh's word. Kirk, we've spent 4 hours over the past 5 days on a single sentence. And look how much is in it. Yeah. God is warning us about the presumptive and arrogant nature of religious power. And that telling us that in religion, the biggest fear, the biggest concern is being intoxicated by it.
Mm-hmm.
So that your judgment is impaired. So that you're forgetful and therefore forgotten. Now that's all very blunt. It's right in your face. Those words mean what the words mean.
Sure.
They're just interpret it literally. What follows is from the first word to the last word is symbolic. It's metaphoric.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like the juxtaposition of the two. So then he's talking about a flower. Now is he really interested in flowers? I think he likes flowers. I like flowers. You like flowers?
Yeah, of course.
Flowers are nice. You think he's talking about flowers?
No.
Has a flower ever been estranged from Yahweh?
No.
No. So he's not talking about flowers here, is he?
No. These are
no. 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 So the flower is a symbol. When he's talking about the Valley of Olives, has there ever been a Valley of Olives?
No.
Ever seen a Valley of Olives?
No.
No. Can a Valley of Olives be estranged from God? Can a Valley of Olives be religious?
No. No, none of the above.
So, the Valley of Olives, just like the flower, is symbolic of something that we are, we would be well served to understand the symbolism. So, what does a flower represent? If you have a plant, what does the flower represent as part of that plant?
That's the pretty part. Yes, the attractive
the pretty,
part.
Yes, the pretty part, the attractive part. And so is it important for us to be attractive to God?
We'd want to be attractive to God.
What makes us unattractive to God?
Well, unattractive when we turn away from Him and we surround ourselves with wannabe gods and ignore His word.
Yeah, in fact, let me go one step further.
Sure.
Well, I think we're unknown to God when we're intoxicated by religion. I think when we are part of the presumptive and arrogant authorities, the crown, those empowered, and we lead people away from God, and we intoxicate the religious, then that makes us really ugly, and God's extraordinarily unattractive from God's point of view.
Yeah. He absolutely hates you.
Yeah, he hates you at that point. He finds you are repulsive. You know, the Pope and all of his fine little get-up, God thinks he is just the ugliest, most reprehensible and disgusting man on earth. And he's got bad company surrounding him. All right, so the flower is the attractive part of the plant. It's also the reproductive part of the plant, isn't it? And so when we're dealing with Ephraim represents someone who was a large group of people who were part of the covenant who are now estranged from it. The covenant is the only way to reproduce vigorous and beneficial life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the flower. So the flower is the attractive part of the plant, and it is the reproductive part of the plant. The symbol of the covenant, does it have anything to do with reproduction?
Absolutely. It's the enlargement of the family of the Bereth covenant. Yeah.
But the circumcision, which is the symbol of the one and only sign of the covenant, is it on the a separation of some foreskin on the male genitalia? And is the male genitalia responsible for reproduction?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what that thing's for, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so do you see a connection here? We're dealing with the flower, the reproductive organ of the plant. And it's debilitated.
Right.
And you've the covenant is about reproduction, about children inheriting their heavenly father's riches,
mm-hmm.
being part of his family, and now you have a religion, by the way, that is focused on the uncircumcised.
Mm-hmm.
That means the flower, the reproductive part of that family, gone, disabled. So that's why the flower is totally symbolic, but you got to think about what do these things represent?
Yeah.
So then the flower's desirability and honor. So the word here, Sosby, speaks both of those things. The desirability of it and the status of it, the prominence of it. And when you're estranged from the covenant, you have no status. When you are part of the covenant, your status is a child of God.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any better status than that.
Not at all. That's part of the family. Royal family.
So much to learn.